Women from around the globe are brainstorming climate change solutions.
What is a feminist perspective on climate change? How do our worldviews need to change?
Plus, connecting kids in a landlocked state to the sea. And student debt problems aren't just about college. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, the Women's Perspective. Last month, women from more than 35 countries gathered in New York to begin work on a sweeping plan to address climate change. Their talks are expected to culminate in a women's climate change agenda, which will be presented to policymakers and stakeholders around the globe. Osprey Oriel Lake is co-organizer of the first annual International Women's Earth and Climate Summit. And fortuitously, the summit came just a week before the release of the UN's Global Climate Risk Assessment compiled by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
Well, I think one of the most important untold stories of climate change really has to do with women's leadership and women's empowerment. Many studies show us that when women are the most negatively impacted by climate change and environmental degradation, yet what's very exciting is that they're key to solutions. And several years ago, having done a lot of my own research on women's role in sustainability issues and learning of a lot of projects and campaigns on the ground, I had this vision to bring women from all over the world together from many different sectors to create a very holistic approach to climate solutions. So the idea was to bring business women together who are involved in sustainable energy, scientists, policymakers, indigenous women, and grassroots leaders, all coming from different entry points, but unified in a common cause. And so I was just very excited to actually have this opportunity to see this vision come into being. And I think one of the things that's really important to understand is that women are central stakeholders in so many issues that have to do with our environment, our economics, and our well-being. As an example, between 60 and 80% of household food production in developing countries is done by women. You know, in parliamentary positions, when women are in charge, we see a lot more progressive and important environmental legislation that is really key and is supportive of the environment. 80% of all consumer purchases in North America are decided by women, so we're really looking at what women can do with their purchasing power and seeing also how we can create a constituency that will demand an end to the use of fossil fuels and certainly the end of fossil fuel subsidies. So when we look at all these different sectors, we're really seeing women as key, and this deeply inspired me, and also working with a lot of colleagues in Tanzania, in different regions in South America, fighting for the forests there, for the Amazon forest, or women that we've worked with in the Congo protecting the forests there. I've just been so inspired by their stories and knowing if we could get together, we could collaborate and lift up the solutions that women are really invested in and also really encourage each other to do more and be able to support each other more.
Did you find that having a group of women leaders at a summit had some sort of a different dynamic than a more mixed gender crowd?
Well, it was very interesting. We had Cristiana Figueres, the Executive Secretary of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. We had Mary Robinson, the former Irish president, Nobel Peace Prize laureate Jody Williams, marine biologist Dr. Sylvia Earle. Then we had, you know, a lot of grassroots leader, Mae Bovey from 350.org. We had environmental activist and physicist Vandana Shiva from India. We had Melina Lubicon Massimo, an indigenous and environmental activist from Canada. A lot of leaders from the Global Gender Climate Alliance, Women's Environment and Development Organization. It was such an amazing mix of women really working together. What we spent time in plenary sessions working on a women's climate action agenda and seeing what are the best practices, what are the most important solutions, what are the best on-the-ground solutions and policies in eight different issue areas. We had eight working groups, and people then spent time in discussion with their colleagues from all over the world in each of these different eight working groups, really deciding, you know, where are the traction points, what are the leverage points from a perspective that really is uplifting women's leadership and women's voices. What is a feminist perspective on climate change? How do our worldviews need to change? Because there is so many different ideas coming from the global south and global north. How do we really create a cohesive strategy that really makes sense and really understands that, you know, women are not all the same, and obviously the needs of women in the global south and global north are quite different. So it was very exciting to see, you know, how do we put a strategy together that makes sense in different types of communities. And we're not finished with it. We got a long ways, and we're very excited about the process. And we plan to put out a report in January of next year after we have a chance to refine the process. And then, of course, we're going to work online with the different working groups and go back and forth editing this document, which we want to present to governments, to heads of state, to different communities, to different kinds of NGO organizations, so that we can really see what, you know, what did women think, these different expert women from all over the world in these different sectors, what do we really think is going to be the most important action plan going forward on climate change?
You mentioned there is a very different perspective between women in the global north versus the concerns of women in the global south. And since most of us listening are in the global north, explain to us what is the difference in that viewpoint.
Well, there's so many, but I'll start with you. I mean, one thing that we heard a lot, you know, from our indigenous delegates, of course, is how, you know, most of the biodiversity on the earth right now is on indigenous lands. I'm not sure the exact figure, but I know it's over 80%. And, you know, a lot of them are in regions where there are extractions going on, whether it's coal or oil. And I think there needs to be a big awareness of how women in the global north, and of course all of us, but we're focusing on women right now, you know, what our consumption habits are and how what we're doing here in North America, as an example, is deeply affecting indigenous communities in the global south, where we're seeing, you know, huge cancer rates or illnesses due to water being polluted because of these extractions that are going on, or entire forests being wiped out because of drilling for oil under these ancient forests. And how that's impacting the communities of the women that came to the summit and hearing their stories, I think, is very important for women in the global north to hear and understand we have a relationship in sharing this earth together. We also need to understand as these forests are being cut down in the Amazon or in the Congo for minerals or for oil, that this is also creating more carbon emissions in the atmosphere. And so this is going to affect all of us. We're all on this one planet, and we're all sharing in what is going on with the health of our earth. And we need to work together to understand that. And this means understanding the situation for women in the global north as well as women in the global south. I think what's very exciting, whether you're thinking of Amazon Watch, which works with indigenous people to protect the rainforests in the Amazon, to some of the women that are working to protect the tar sands up in Canada. I mean, there's so many organizations doing incredible work. 350 has been very, very effective. La Via Campesina, which is has a membership of like 200 million people. They were represented here. Colleen Ross from La Via Campesina was here telling us about how farmers are organizing. I think that there's a lot of hope in what's going on with the work on the ground and the grassroots already. I think the need is to move at speed and scale and to collaborate more. I mean, you know, the fact that we did hit 400 parts per million of carbon emissions in the atmosphere earlier this year, which we know we need to be at 350 parts per million or less for a healthy planet, is letting us know that what we're doing is not enough. There's a lot of great work going on, but clearly we're not winning enough in terms of what needs to happen in terms of what nature is showing us and demonstrating to us through extreme weather events that we're seeing all over the world now. So the hope is in the fact of so many people rolling up their sleeves and really caring and working together. The difficult part is, you know, how much time do we have in this time of such quick-paced ecological tipping points? And I think that's where we're really seeing we have this short window of opportunity to really change the trajectory. And the hope is that a lot of people are working to do something about the problem.
Osprey Oriel Lake is co-organizer of the first annual International Women's Earth and Climate Summit. Find out more at IWECI.org.
Ah, these times are so uncertain. There's a yearning undefined. People filled with rage. We all need a little tenderness. How can love survive in such a graceless age?
Up next, getting students in a landlocked state connected to the ocean. If you missed part of this show or want to share it, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1265. Mary Cook teaches 7th and 8th grade a long way from the sea. She says Arkansas has rice fields, duck hunting, and the international headquarters for Walmart. But she was looking for a way to help her students engage with the ocean. Ari Daniel Shapiro has more.
I've always found it difficult to teach my students, who are most of them are around 13 years old, about the ocean because most of them have not been to the ocean. And so I've always been looking for ways to make it more personable.
Mary Cook came across a program called Teacher at Sea. It's run by NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And it gives teachers, from kindergarten teachers all the way to college-level teachers, the chance to board a NOAA research cruise and work side by side with scientists and crew to learn about and help do the science. Cook read through the different cruises that were available.
There was one particular voyage that was going to be looking at climate and climate change and gathering data and deploying buoys on tsunamis, and those are things that I teach. And so I just thought, okay, I'll apply for it. Maybe they'll pick me, maybe they won't.
They did pick her, and just like that, Cook's dream gave way to the reality of getting ready to go to sea for 3 weeks far off the coast of Chile. The chief scientist for the cruise was going to be Bob Weller, a physical oceanographer from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Cook got her principal's approval to participate. She found a substitute teacher, but all this turned out to be the easy part.
Before I left, I was really, really worried. I knew I would love the science. I mean, that I didn't worry about that. I was worried that I would be on that ship and want to get off. I would begin to view it kind of like a prison. But I'm kind of a person that if I'm afraid of something, then I'm just going to go ahead and make myself go through with it because I want to conquer that. But it didn't take long after I was on the ship and we were out to sea to realize that I never, ever felt like it was a prison at all. When you can't see any land for 3 weeks, it's kind of a liberating to just look at sky and water.
And every day, Cook wrote a blog with stories and pictures for her students. She told them about how the science team was studying the Earth's climate by using buoys and drifters and probes to measure the ocean and the atmosphere. Her students emailed her back, and Cook was sure to let them know when the buoy they'd adopted as a class was released into the ocean to track the temperature and pressure of a particular current. It was this buoy, more than anything else, that caused her students' interest to skyrocket.
They signed these stickers, and then I took the stickers with me, and when I got to the ship and to the little buoy, I put all of their stickers on. Then I took pictures and posted them on the internet. The interest in ocean currents, quadrupled among my students because of that. And so they knew, that was their adopted buoy.
I was reading this, your reflections on your Teacher at Sea experience, and at one point you say that even though the Teacher at Sea cruise took place a few years ago, it continues to be the potent force in my approach to teaching my students about oceanic and atmospheric sciences today. And I just wondering why.
Because it's so personal. And I think if you can make it more personal for the teacher and the students, they're going to remember it. I've talked to those students that I had 5 years ago, and one of them, I saw him a couple of weeks ago, and he was talking about his graduation night, that he wore his NOAA pin on his graduation gown. So to me, it made a great impact on them. It's so personal to me, and I learned so much. I mean, I had read about research, but now I know about it, and I've participated in it.
At Alf Junior High, Cook's current students agree. Brett Blasco is one. He's in the eighth grade. Before moving to Arkansas, he grew up on the ocean in Washington State.
I enjoy the ocean, like, in the summer, because my dad lives in California, so we go to the ocean, swim.
So does the fact that Miss Cook kind of went on this trip and was one of the first teachers ever to kind of go out to sea, does that make her kind of extra cool?
Yeah, I think it helps because it shows that she's been there and she knows what it's like, and it's more interesting to look at and get more into.
Emily Rollins is also in the eighth grade. She's from Searcy, Arkansas, but Rollins has gotten to see the ocean on vacation in Mexico. Studying the ocean is her favorite part of science class.
Yeah.
Why do you say it's your favorite subject?
Because I've always liked, you know, being near water and around the ocean. I think it's very interesting how, you know, the ocean affects our climate.
Do you actually see that in Arkansas?
Yes. Because, you know, when Louisiana has its hurricane season, we kind of get the sort of the aftermath, what was left over from that up here. But mostly it comes in real heavy rains or tornadoes. Even though, you know, Arkansas isn't touching the ocean anywhere, it still affects us.
You think you want to do something with the oceans in the future?
Well, the thing I would like to learn to do with the oceans, like, learn about the marine life that lives there. And I thought that would be a good job option for the future.
So if you could have one wish about the ocean, what would that be?
If I could constantly live there forever, because I love being there. It's kind of like being surrounded by a whole different world.
The beauty of the Teacher at Sea program is it lets the students in a classroom touch that different world, help them feel connected to the ocean in a way that's lasting and meaningful. The program's been around since 1990, and more than 500 teachers from across the country have participated. If Mary Cook's experience is any indication, it can really lead to a sea change in how teachers and students alike relate to the ocean.
Right, because it opened a lot of doors in that respect for me. And so now when I'm looking for lessons, it means something to me when I see it. And I can also turn around and explain that to my students.
Now that you've been on the sea and you've actually gotten to know the ocean in a very intimate way, I'm wondering if you can kind of, you know, describe what your relationship is with the ocean, you know, like personally.
Some of my impressions of the ocean was how big it was. I mean, I was just overwhelmed at its depth. Something I do remember is thinking that the ocean felt like it was breathing because it has this constant kind of swaying or moving. That's kind of a comforting feeling. Instead of being afraid, I felt more comforted by it.
This was last week's Sonic Stumper. It's Arkansas's state song called O Arkansas.
Of the lakes, it's the spirit that's in each and every home.
Maybe they should add just one more line. It's the spirit of the ocean.
It's the spirit of tomorrow and today. Oh, Arkansas. Oh, Arkansas. Arkansas, USA.
Here's our new Sonic Stumper.
And all the leaves on the trees are falling to the sounds of the breezes that flow.
Okay, what we're listening to is a type of fun activity you might do. What is it? Sail over to our website, oceangazing.org, to see photos of Mary Cook at sea and of her students. You can also find a link to a beautiful children's book that Cook co-authored about her voyage on the high seas. Let her know what you think of her Teacher at Sea trip by posting a message on our blog, oceangazing.org.
Student debt is a huge problem in this country. We know many families struggle to afford traditional colleges, but a lot of student debt comes from attending private, for-profit schools that focus on vocational training. These students default on their loans twice as often as students from public colleges. Kate Davidson has the story of one small school battling big defaults for the Changing Gears Project.
America's student loan debt is now bigger than its credit card debt. It's almost $1 trillion, and default rates are rising.
I guess I do what everybody else has been doing, dodging the phone calls, you know, because we don't have $15,000 to pay.
Mark Howell is on the verge of default. In fact, the school he went to has the highest student loan default rate in Michigan. It's not U of M, not Kalamazoo College.
You stay still.
It's Barber College. In Ohio and Wisconsin, beauty schools have the highest default rates. Now, these are small schools, so their default rates are volatile. But this is a story about why those rates matter at the Flint Institute of Barbering. So picture an overgrown barbershop. It's big and cheap and cheerful.
What style of haircut do you want?
College boy.
Desmond is 5. The student palming his head like a basketball is 50. Tom Amundsen was an auto designer for 30 years, but got laid off. Enter his buddy, the barber.
He talked to me about it. He said, why don't you get into the business? And I said, kind of old. And he said, no, you're never too old to cut hair.
So Amundsen took out federal loans, just like 3/4 of his class. Martha Polis runs this school. It's $8,000 for a year. But she says most of her students are low income. So the cost of living and supporting kids and just avoiding poverty, all of it affects default rates.
The 3-year-ago rate was 15.5%. Our 2008 cohort was 29%. Our 2009 cohort, and these are the official rates, was 30.5%.
That means almost a third of those who started repaying their loans in fiscal year 2009 had defaulted 2 years later.
We were very alarmed and not happy, and we're trying to work as much as we can and do the best we can.
Now, this is a woman who will dye her students' jeans black.
I have to use a laundry tub
by hand
and stir it and leave it there for hours and hours and hours and overnight.
If they can't afford to meet the school's dress code. But in the end, she hired a service to track students who are delinquent on their loans. She says she had to. Schools with high default rates can lose access to federal student aid, and more than half the school's revenue comes from that aid.
They are so reliant on federal financial aid dollars.
David Deming is an assistant professor at Harvard's Graduate School of Education. He's talking about the larger for-profit sector, which he says gets almost 75% of its revenue from federal student aid. And as for students who borrow money,
if you take out a 5-figure loan for a relatively short program, if you don't find employment relatively soon after that program, it's going to be very hard to pay back your loan.
Time slips away in between all of that, you know what I'm saying? And it is not going to wait for you.
Remember Mark Howell? He's working. He's cutting hair in a kind of hard-to-find corner of a mall in Flint, and he loves it. But he says building clientele is slow in a town that's saturated with barbers.
You can make the payments, but at the same time, you're trying to find work to make the payments. And if you don't make the payments, you got to deal with the consequences behind that, which is your license at stake.
He's already gotten a couple loan deferments. In the meantime, he says he's scratching and hustling to make ends meet, and he's not the only one. For Changing Gears, I'm Kate Davidson in Flint.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. If you'd like to connect with us on Facebook, you can find 51% there. And you can also email me at sbarnett@wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.